Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 10th, 2006, and this is show number 73. Well, happy birthday, Kelly. I hope you're having a good sail with Dad today. Man, is it just me, or are things starting to get really busy already? I'm running ragged right now. Lindsay's home from school, which is just wonderful. We've got Christmas shopping going on, 4 cars to wash and wax now, Kyle's birthday's next week, and the rain keeps dropping these really annoying dirty leaves on my driveway, so I have to keep cleaning them up, not just the leaves, but the dirt they leave behind. It's a glorious tree, actually. It's a 70-foot Dutch elm tree, which the previous owner of our property carted out from the Midwest to California in the back of a truck. Well, it wasn't 70 feet tall back then, duh. Anyway, in the spring, there's nothing more beautiful than the bright green leaves when they're coming in on that tree. Millions and millions of them. However, in the fall, instead of turning golden and yellow like any self-respecting Midwest tree, the leaves turn just this kind of mucky brown and somehow get like full of dirt. For all I can figure, I think they're collecting smog or something. Oh well, it did give me an excuse to use the power washer I got for Mother's Day this year. That was fun. Maybe in springtime I'll post a picture of the tree so you can see how good it looks when it's in its full glory. Well, I guess it's time to get back to talking technology, huh? So, remember our long sojourn into recipe programs for the Mac? One of the reasons I enlisted your help finding applications for listener Dean was that my husband and I are both engineers, and therefore impaired in the cookie imagination category. Listener Bruce was nice enough to write in with a hilarious link, except it's serious. It's to a site called cookingforengineers.com. Isn't that a great idea? The front page has articles like Baguettes Reconstructed. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Baguettes Deconstructed, and IEEE Spectrum Radio Looking for Engineers Who Cook. Only a site called Cooking for Engineers would have a link to equipment and gear. That's where you can learn about knife sharpening and hardness and common materials of cookware. I really like the area in there called Ingredients Dictionary. In there, you can find photos of each ingredient. I mean, come on, how many times have you been sent to the store to get something for the real cook, and it's something like, let's say, cilantro? And you're looking at cilantro and parsley and trying to figure out which one is which. And you're sniffing them, and you're looking at them, you're trying to find a picture, but nobody's helping you. Well, if you had these handy ingredients dictionary, you'd be able to whip up the picture and know for sure you bought the right thing. Of course, you'd look like an idiot carrying your laptop to the grocery store, but oh well. There's also a community forum, which is nice, because it's better that engineers talk to each other than bothering other people. So check out cookingforengineers.com. I have quite a few friends this could help. There's a great Mac podcast called The Mac Attack from the macattack.us with host Steve Stanger. He's got some great tips and hints and sounds like a really nice guy to me. His content is absolutely excellent. Imagine my delight when I'm listening along and I hear Steve say, "Pat writes in that Allison of the NoSilicast said that AppDelete works way better than AppZapper, which doesn't get all the files, and AppDelete is free." Hey, Pat, thanks for sending that on to Steve. Made me feel famous to hear him say it. Listener Ryan went through his Mac and looked at all the freeware and shareware he uses, and he sent me links and explanations for all that good stuff. This is going to be some great material for the podcast over the next few weeks, I think. The first one that caught my eye was called Todos, which I believe in Spanish means all. Todos, from dbachrach.com, that's dbachrach.com, is a freeware application that, when launched, shows you a grid of all of the icons of all of the applications on your computer. They're beautifully done on a black background, very dramatic. As you move your cursor over the different icons, just kind of floating over it, in the upper left corner, it shows you the icon larger with the name of the application you're hovering over. The icon you're hovering over also gets a gray square around the small one, and all of your currently open applications have a pale green box around them. This is another one of those things where it sounds so mechanical as I describe it, but it's actually a really eye-pleasing way to view your applications and choose the one you want. Sometimes the icon catches my attention more than the name, so this could be useful too. Of course, with the 240-some-odd applications I have on there, it's not a really practical way to do it, but I think you can change it and set it so certain applications don't show up, so just the good ones are in there. I did put a screen snapshot in the show notes showing all of my applications. I'd love to see listener Tim take a screen snapshot of his because of his Toto screen, because he has even more applications than I do. Here's another good tip from listener Ryan. Have you ever been working along on your laptop, thinking it's plugged into power, and suddenly you see that message says, "Your battery is almost out. Hurry up and plug it in." Happens to me more often than I'd like. In fact, happened to me last Monday. Somebody unplugged my power and snaked the power source. I was really mad. So that's when I decided to try out the free macWare application recommended by Ryan called Unplugged from BrickSoftware.com. Now, Brick is spelled B-R-I-K. The website says it uses Growl to do the notifications or with an alert window if Growl is not installed. I vaguely remember playing around with something called Growl a while ago, and I could never figure out what I was supposed to do with it. I kept thinking it would growl at me or something, but nothing ever happened. Maybe I'll go back and put it back in and see if it helps with this application, but I don't think you actually need it. I downloaded Unplugged and discovered that it's actually a preference pane. For those of you that are Windows users, it's sort of like a control panel, but more embedded in the OS than an application or a utility. Upon double-clicking Unplugged, it launches the preference pane window and asks whether to install for this user only or for all users. Let me make a little lecture here. I strongly encourage you, whenever faced with this question, to only install for this user. You should always keep a pristine admin user account with no alterations to it. This gives you a way to be able to diagnose problems when things go all hinky on you. If you have a problem that you're having trouble tracking down, and you switch to the clean account and it goes away, then you know it's a problem in the account, not some OS-level problem or a scary hardware problem. All right, enough lecture, back to Unplugged. The interface is nice and simple. You can choose to have the application start on login, and you can tell it that when certain applications are active, you do not want to be notified of power changes. I put a picture in the show notes so you can see how I've told it not to notify me if GarageBand is active. Something I don't need any disturbances when I'm doing a recording. I can barely pay attention this long as it is. So you simply click the plus sign at the bottom of the window to add more applications to that list of the ones that you don't want to be interrupted during. There's one part of Unplugged I just don't get. There's a slider that goes from 0 to 50%. There's some text to the left of it with a checkbox. The text says, quote, "Notify when battery capacity changes EV." Not even less than, or even more than, or eventually. It just changes EV. What the heck does that mean? I played around with it a bit, toggled the checkbox on and off, moved the slider up and down to different levels, and I couldn't figure out anything that changed with or without that setting. And there's a second tab called Appearance, and it allows you to set the text that is displayed when your power is plugged or unplugged. I was kind of disappointed in that, though. I changed mine to say, "Hey, moron, you knocked the power plug out again." But this change didn't actually take effect, and it still says, "Now running with battery power." Well, that's no fun. I wanted to be obnoxious. As usual, I've gone into an elaborate description of something that's completely simple. If you install Unplugged, hit Start, then whenever you knowingly or unknowingly unplug power, it'll pop up a small window notifying you of that fact. When you've successfully plugged your power back in, it'll tell you that too. So a couple of weeks ago, I told you about a fabulous free tool called Pando. It was invented to allow large file transfers very, very quickly. One of the things I questioned was that on their website that they said that they use BitTorrent technology. As I've explained before, BitTorrent is a great technology for transferring huge files. It allows you to get bits from lots of people at the same time. That's very efficient because most internet services are slower uploading than downloading. So if you can download from lots of people at once, you can add their collective bandwidth up until you fill your own download pipe. Anyway, I was trying to figure out how that would help with Pando, where you're just transferring a file from one person to another. It didn't really seem to make sense. Well, this week I figured it out. One unique feature of Pando is that I can start uploading a huge file or folder full of files to you, and you can actually start to download them before I'm done. So they must be letting you download bits, huh? So you're not getting like the upper left-hand corner, but you're getting electronic bits of the file. I can pause the upload, and you can download until you've got all the bits I've put up. You can also pause the download, leaving the bits I've uploaded still there waiting. This is really interesting that they've used pieces of the BitTorrent technology and made an awesome product. And I'm not just saying that because they sent me a shirt. I'm really proud of my epiphany on this subject, and I figured it out myself. Well, this is the second installment of our 26-part series on Google products. Actually, I don't know if it's 26. I just made that up because it sounded good. Today, we'll start with Google Catalogs at catalogs.google.com. There aren't a lot of categories from which to choose, only about 16 of them, but Google specializes in simplicity, right? I'll think of some catalogs I like first, and then see what Google Catalogs can do for me. We'll start with one computer catalog. Huh? Only one? Well, I gotta be unbiased, right? I'll choose ThinkGeek, which is a great catalog for geeky toys, even if I did have a falling out with them after they charged me $17 for shipping in time for Christmas to Canada 2 years ago and then delivered it after Christmas and would not give me my money back. So I typed in ThinkGeek into Google Catalogs, and it came back with CyberGuys. Well, CyberGuys is probably one of my favorite geek catalogs, but it's not ThinkGeek. So it came back with a suggestion of ThinkGeek, all one word, instead of Think Space Geek. So I clicked on that, but then it said it didn't have any match to that. So why did it offer it to me if it didn't have it? Not exactly a full success on the first try, but at least it gave me the links to CyberGuys catalog. I went ahead and checked out the CyberGuys catalog. Google gives you four different page options. There's an overview kind of layout, which is two pages to a section, and there's six sections on the screen at the same time. So basically, you've got 24 scanned-in pages up at the same time all together, which means you can't see anything on any of them. Your next choice is a two-up, which is still pretty small, but if you click on any of the pages, you get the third view, which is a close-up of one page. So now at least you can see the pictures and read the headlines, and if you're very young, you might be able to decipher some of the text. Luckily, there's a fourth option, which is a real close-up where you can actually see the pictures and read the text. While this is functional, I'm not sure a catalog running in the hundreds of pages is all that practical to scan like this. It did come up pretty quickly, though, which was good. Next up, let's find something in the clothing line. How about Coldwater Creek, my favorite clothing catalog? Again, Google Catalogs did not find it, but it gave me the suggestion of spelling it exactly the same way I did spell it. So I clicked on that link and it said, I can't find that. Okay, well, I also tried Urban Outfitters, my daughter's favorite catalog, and it showed me the Orvis fly fishing catalog. Gee, I don't really think that's what she had in mind, do you? All right, let's take another approach. Let's just take a look at a category they already have and see if there's a catalog in there I like. I checked out the consumer electronics category, and they had a grand total of 19. Not so many, I think, considering it's the geeks who would actually think to look at a search thing like this. I did find the Sharper Image catalog, and I thought they may have the cordless electric knife I've been looking for, so I tried the search capability, and I did find knives in the catalog, so that was good, but they didn't seem to have the cordless electric one that I could have sworn Sharper Image carried. So I decided to double-check it, and I went over to sharperimage.com, typed in knife, and the third item in the list was the electric knife I was looking for. I suppose it's possible that the knife isn't in the real catalog, but I'm kind of betting that it was. Overall, I'd have to say that Google Catalogs was pretty much a bust. Nothing compelling to get me to spend a lot of time there, so don't waste your time either. The next two tools in Google's lineup will be hard for me to test. Google Checkout is a direct competitor to PayPal and is available at https checkout.google.com. Note there's an S after HTTP. The intention is to have a secure checkout system where you enter your personal information once, including the credit card number, and that weird little three-digit code they're always asking for. They say they have a fraud protection service, but I'm not really sure how it works, but I'm sure it's good. I trust Google. Anyway, they don't charge the buyer a fee for using the service, so I assume, just like PayPal, that the seller pays a fee. I couldn't find anywhere in the terms of the agreement how much the seller does pay, though. I created an account for myself. I'll do anything for the show. And then I said, okay, what do we do next? Well, here's the hard part. To use Google Checkout, you have to find stores that use Google Checkout. I don't know about you, but I'm not too likely to choose my shopping by what checkout service they use. Are you? I tell you what, I'll keep my eyes peeled as I do my Christmas shopping, and if I see that Google Checkout logo, I'll be sure to give you a full report on how well it works. Google Desktop at desktop.google.com is next on the list, but I'm not really going to be able to check that one out either. I think most people have tried this out, and it gets rave reviews. The reason I can't load it is because of a security flaw in the logic of the way it's implemented. I don't know that it's really a flaw, but from my company's perspective, we see that it is. My machine goes on the corporate network, and it's inadvisable for me to put the tool on my machine. The flaw is that the tool stores the search information of what's on your machine on their servers. I'm sure there's a better technical explanation than that, but you can imagine that your company probably doesn't want competition-sensitive information up on someone else's servers, right? The good news is that there is an enterprise version of Google Desktop, and my company is implementing that. It gives all the great capability, but without the security risk. When we get that loaded up, maybe I could do a better review for those of you who have not put Google Desktop in place on your own machines. I guess I should mention that this tool is Windows only, but that's not a real drag, because from what I've heard, it adds spotlight-like capability to XP, so that our Windows brethren can finally search their own machines without waiting for an eternity. The next Google tool on the list is called, simply, Directory. I'd never seen this one before. I told you there's lots of hidden gems in Google. Let's find out if this one is a gem. Directory says it allows you to browse the web by topic and is available at google.com/DIRHP. I wonder why they went with that goofy URL. I mean, all the other ones were, you know, you would have thought it'd be directory.google.com, but it wasn't. It ends in dirhp. I wonder if Hewlett-Packard helped him with this? Oh well, let's go explore the directory. The directory page starts with a bunch of categories shown, like arts, home, computers, recreation, a whole slew of them. And they each have subcategories. Like, I clicked on computers, and within there it has hardware, internet, and software. Let's say I'm looking for a new digital camera. I clicked on the shopping category, and it opened a new Google directory window with about 30 categories, looking much like what you'd find if you're searching message boards like Yahoo Groups or Google Groups. I did find consumer electronics in the list with 3,392 items within it. Yikes! Let's go in there. Once I got into consumer electronics, now there were about 15 more subcategories, one of which was cameras and photography. There was also a way to search by letter of the first letter of the name of what you're looking for, I guess, and a related categories section. I thought I'd go into cameras and photography first. Again, I get more subcategories. I wonder if you heard that bell. Remember I had that thing set to not hear it? Or I'm hearing ringing in my ears. I don't know. Anyway, so now I can see a list of web pages for this category viewed in Google Page Rank Order. I can also choose to have it viewed in alphabetical order. In page rank order, B&H Photo and Video takes the top spot, which makes perfect sense. The next 10 hits, though, were places I'd never heard of. Well, I decided to dig another category deeper by hitting the link for digital. This was a complete disappointment, because nothing in that last category I picked actually showed me anything about buying a digital camera. It was things like services and accessories. At the top of the Google search window right there, I had a choice of search only in digital or search the directory. I left it on the digital button, and I did a search on the word Canon, figuring I'd get hits on Canon cameras. And it did not find any hits at all. So I'm in digital, in photography and cameras, and I search on Canon and it doesn't find anything. It's not too good. So I thought I'll search the directory instead for Canon, and it got a whole bunch of hits. Then I thought, I wonder whether I should compare that search list to what if I had just searched Canon on Google.com to start with. Well, I compared the two, and guess what? It was the exact same list for like the top 10 hits. So I think I would stick with Google.com instead of, you know, digging my way through all these little categories and things. I don't quite know what problem it solves. So for now, I'm going to give it a thumbs down. Perhaps if you didn't know what you were looking for, it would help you categorize your thoughts, but it sure didn't seem to help me. I'm starting to wonder whether the reason we don't know about some of these obscure Google offerings is that they're really not all that great, so they don't get the viral attention of the good stuff like Picasa and Google Earth. Well, we've got more tools left to look at, a whole bunch more, so stay tuned for next week's installment of our Google Tools review, and I sure hope I can give you some good ones instead of three or four thumbs down. Last week on the podcast, I talked about some cool flash clocks that Honda Bob sent to me, but I bemoaned the fact that they lived inside the browser window and that I would have to surf over to their website in order to get to them. I would love to have them live on my screen instead. They did have one or two that worked as screensavers, but they were only for Windows. Listener Bill wrote in with some very interesting comments. Allison, thanks for this great link. Too bad it just contains Windows screensavers. They do work well on my Windows desktop. Maybe you already know this, but I thought I should mention it to you. At the website for flash clocks, if you right-click on the link marked Click Here for Bigger Version, you can download the link to your desktop. You get a small file named timeline.swf, for example, if you click on the timeline clock. I downloaded and moved all of these SWF files to a folder named Flash Clocks, which I stored at the root of my C drive. So it's in C:\, or is that forward slash? That's why I never say the slashes. I don't know. C:, Flash Clocks. In Firefox, I have set up my folders in my bookmarks toolbar, one of which is named Time and Date. It contains various calendars and other links. I open up Firefox and the Flash Clocks folder and drag each of my SWF files to my Time and Date tab/folder in my bookmarks toolbar. I can right-click on each SWF file to get properties and then rename it to the appropriate name, say Timeline, for example. The location field then reads file:\\C:\flashclocks/timeline.swf, for example. I then can play each clock without regard to whether I am connected to the internet or whether the link still exists on the internet, because the clock is actually on his hard disk. Hope this makes sense and is helpful. Thanks for all your great podcasts. Please keep them coming. Regards, Bill. Well, thank you, Bill, for your kind words and for an innovative idea. I don't know what made you think of that trick, but it does actually work. I know I went through that kind of fast for the people listening, but as always, the text is in the show notes, so you can go back and follow along. I did the same thing on my Mac, with only a slight variation on the file location syntax. I put the flash files I downloaded into my downloads folder and embedded them in a folder called Flash Clocks. The syntax for pointing to the Firefox bookmarks to the files was file:\\Allison/download/flashclocks/timeline.swf. I thought it was interesting that the syntax is nearly the same for both operating systems. Both of them started with file:\3. And after that, you use the normal syntax of the respective file system. I took a screen snapshot of my favorite clock called Dimensions. But the reason I did it was to show how hard my machine has to work when Flash is playing. In the shot, if you have really good eyes, you can see that my CPUs are cranked into the 80% range, and the temperature of my CPU is up to 42 degrees C. That's about as hot as I can hold it without my palm getting too hot. A couple hours after I took that screen snapshot, I looked at it the way I had it sized to go in the show notes, and I realized it was kind of small to be able to see the temperature and CPU usage. So I thought, hey, I'll take another one, but this time I'll shrink the size of the Firefox window so the clock is a lot smaller, but you can still see the whole clock, but the menu meters will be a bigger percentage of the shot. Lo and behold, when I shrank the Firefox window to half size, the CPU usage cut in half. How wild is that? Instead of seeing 80% CPU usage, I was only seeing 40%. Evidently, it's using CPU power to draw on the screen, and if it only has to draw half as much, it drains half as much of the processor power. I thought that was pretty interesting. Overall, though, Flash is such a hog. I'd really like to know, is it badly implemented on the Intel-based Macs, or does everyone see this problem? I'd sure like to hear from some of you on this. In any case, I think Bill came up with a very clever way to put these clocks at our fingertips. And even though it's a bit of an advanced solution, if I could figure it out, I'm confident that you can too. Ages ago, I talked about how to move DVD movies onto your iPod using an application called Handbrake, which is freeware for the Mac from handbrake.m0k.org. But I had a bear of a time finding freeware apps to do it on a PC. If I remember correctly, I did eventually figure it out. I can't remember who sent me this next tip. Seems to me it was probably Niraj. But now there's an open source application called Handbrake for Windows, available at prdownloads.sourceforge.net/TiVo-mplayer. As you can tell by the name of the link, which is of course in the show notes, this is part of an effort to enhance the player on Windows for TiVo downloads. If you click to download the mPlayer, you also get a link for Handbrake 0.7.1, along with an application called Cygwin. Now, I'm no expert on this stuff, but my understanding of Cygwin is that it's an open source package that has tons of things inside it, including C compilers and an X-Terminal client application. With that little bit of info, I have no idea why it's part of the Handbrake installation. I'm not good enough on the Windows side to do a full exploration of this tool, but if you're looking for a freeware method to get your DVDs onto your iPod or other devices, check out Handbrake for Windows. Note that this tool does not remove the copy protection from commercial DVDs. You'll need to hunt down another tool like DVD Shrink if you want to go down that path. Well, those wonderful people at Parallels have done it again. They released yet another upgrade to their product. These guys are amazing. There's only been a couple of upgrades that I would characterize as ho-hum. The rest are all in the wow category. This upgrade is one of the most dramatic improvements so far. For those of you who are new to the show, Parallels is a $79 application that allows us to run Windows and Linux on our Intel-based Macintoshes at the same time that we're running Mac OS X. It's sort of like the old virtual PC, but sort of like I resemble my great aunt B is how it resembles virtual PC. Parallels is screaming fast and runs like a dream. I don't know everything the new version can do yet, but here's a sampling of what I have found out. One of the most enjoyable party tricks is you can now drag and drop files between the two operating systems. Let's say, for example, I have a file on the desktop in OS X. I can just drag that file onto the Windows desktop, and it copies it over there. This is so much fun. I did it all afternoon at work, dragging people into my office to show them. Drag, drop, drag, drop. It was very exciting. You can do it both ways, too. One hassle that Parallels used to have, but I kind of took for granted it was just the nature of the beast, was that if you wanted to change the size of your Windows window, you had to go into the Windows Desktop Properties control panel and change the screen resolution. So, for example, making it 640 by 480 would make the window that floats inside OS X smaller. Does that make sense? Well, no worries. You don't have to understand it because you don't have to do it anymore. All you do is grab the corner of the window and drag, and it changes to whatever shape and size you want. A great feature of Parallels has always been that you can pause the virtual machine. That's the name they give to the guest operating system, which can be Windows, Linux, Solaris, a bunch of different operating systems. Pausing it means you can quit Parallels, and when you relaunch later, Windows opens up right where you left it. No need to boot it up, restart it, launch your applications, they're all right where you left them. It's really a great time saver. The only thing I didn't like was that it took a fair length of time to actually execute the pause, which took away some of the time savings. And it seemed to chew up a lot of processor power while it was doing it, which made it hard to work on anything else at the same time. I don't know how they did it, but now when you hit pause, the virtual machine goes gray almost immediately and goes into this pause state. If you tell it to quit parallels, it does this really cool graphic of the window shrinking and spinning down into a spiral. It's really fun to watch. It doesn't actually quit instantly, but they had fun with that too. In the dock, they take the parallel symbol, which is sort of like an 8 on its side, and they flip it upright and made it into an hourglass. Sand pours from top to bottom, then it flips over and does it again, all just to keep you entertained while you wait. At the same time that the hourglass is going, there's sort of like a, what's a way to describe it, like a clock hand going around from 12 o'clock all the way back to 12 o'clock, and when it gets back to the top, it's completely finished. It's really kind of fun. Overall, the time it takes to pause and then quit the virtual machine seems quite a bit shorter. One final enhancement they added was an interesting way to actually look at the virtual machine. They've always had two options. One is called OS View, and that's where you see a floating window that contains everything in the virtual machine. It's got the desktop, the icons, the toolbars, application windows, all kinds of windows that are captive in this one big floating window. They also have a full screen mode, which is really fun to enable. When you choose full screen, it animates from OS X to the guest OS using different animations of your choice. The popular one is it makes it like it's a cube, as though OS X is on one side of the cube and on a corner side is the guest operating system. Well, they've added one more option now of how to look at it, and they call it coherency mode. I have no idea what the name actually means in this context, but coherency allows you to have each window in the guest OS actually float independently on top of OS X. Let me try to explain a little better. Picture this. You've got Firefox for Windows in one window, and another you've got Excel for Windows, and in a third window is Excel for the Mac. They're all just floating in OS X. The other cool thing is that at the bottom of your screen, you can see the taskbar from the bottom of Windows. So you've got the start menu and all that kind of stuff. And then across the top of your screen, you get all of the Mac OS X menus. So both OSs are just living in peace and harmony. Isn't it beautiful? It brings a tear to your eye, doesn't it? Well, anyway, I put a little video in the show notes so you can see all these things in action if you like. So head on over to podfeet.com and check it out. It really is much better to see it than to hear my explanation without pictures. Well, research czar Bart did something really mean. He introduced me to something new that sucked up my imagination, and I didn't get near enough time in on writing up my show notes as a result. He also made sure, as always, to give me something I couldn't pronounce. This appears to be a hobby of his, starting with an unpronounceable last name, to names of college programs I can't pronounce, and now an application that fits the bill, too. Anyway, what he sent me is a terrific program, so I'll let you hear his words and forgive me for not pronouncing it correctly. Maybe Bart should consider recording his ideas instead of emailing them to me. I'd love you to hear him for yourself. He's got a terrific sense of humor, and his style is completely unique. Let's read his letter here. Hi, Allison. I'm a huge fan of fractals. I even managed to get to play with them for my undergraduate computer science thesis. There's a really cool freeware tool that is cross-platform that does really nice real-time fractal exploration. It's called Xaos. That's X-A-O-S. Thanks, Bart. Anyway, it was only recently released for the Mac, and I had the pleasure of helping the developer knock the bugs off of it on the Mac as a tester. Anyhow, the main page for Xaos is here, and he gives a 438-character URL that's, of course, in the show notes. He gives us the download section and the best Mac version. The one he helped debug is also on the show notes. He says, I know you love software that everyone can play with, so enjoy. Man, I'm starting to wonder, what doesn't Bart know about, you know? I downloaded and installed Xaos, and the README gave me just enough information to get started. Remember that last week I explained that fractals are shapes that no matter how closely you look at them, you still see the same shapes that you saw in the original view. Xaos starts with a classic Mandelbrot, which looks sort of like a kidney-shaped thing with a blob stuck to it, and all around there are these little fiery edge pieces. As you zoom in, the README says to push with your mouse, and it'll zoom in, hold the Shift key and drag to pan. It doesn't matter how far in you zoom, you keep finding the exact same imagery up close, these little fiery edges. According to the documentation, you can zoom in indefinitely and still see the same shapes. Well, I don't know about infinite zoom, but at least it kept doing it until I got bored, and it was still the same image shape. I put a couple of screenshots in the show notes so you could see it. Well, that was a pretty good time waster, but the real fun was when I started going through the tutorials on the site, or in the tool, I should say. I was mesmerized by this tutorial. It's imagery with text, but no audio, which kept my focus on the video really well. They do a great job of explaining how to create a fractal from the very most basic of terms. Don't be afraid. Go check it out. I've only made it through the first couple of sections of the tutorial, and I can't wait to get to the rest of it. I would have gotten farther through all of this, except Bart IM'd me right about then, and we goofed off for about an hour. It's all his fault, I tell you. Check out the links in the show notes to the downloads for both Windows and Mac, and go waste an afternoon of your own. Well, it looks like that's going to wind up this week's episode of the NoSillaCast. Please keep all those great software and website tips coming. It's so much fun having you do the research for me. Drop me a line at allison@podfeet.com, or if you're so inclined, make a voice recording and send it to nosillacast@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the forums at podfeet.com/forums to talk amongst yourselves. Leo has started a holiday wish list, so go add your favorite item to the list. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.